Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Katie Weaver. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Brazil's lack of dependable internet service in rural areas is an increasingly critical problem for farmers. It comes at a time when more agriculture equipment arriving on the market depends on modern telecommunications. Some pieces of equipment require the internet for computer software updates. These programs help the machinery operate at full capacity. Brazil's agriculture industry has grown quickly over the past 10 years. This has put the country as a leader of food production worldwide. But problems involving technology and other infrastructure remain. This includes the issue of internet coverage. Jim Patrício Passos is the Brazil-based business of Telecom Italia SpA, Italy's largest telecommunications company. The business estimates that less than 10% of Brazilian farms have internet access. As a comparison, over 70% of farmers in the United States have access to high-speed internet. That information comes from a 2017 report by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. This is a structural issue that we have in Brazil that we need to solve, notes Christian Gonzalez. He is an official with Case IH, the Agricultural Machines Division of CNH Industrial NV. He spoke with the Reuters news agency. Gonzalez pointed out that modern equipment, such as harvesters and planters, can be updated while they are operating. This makes them able to produce more with less wasted time or effort. U.S. equipment maker John Deere was one of the first to try and deal with this problem. In 2018, John Deere partnered with telecommunications provider Tropico to provide rural internet service in Brazil. They offered to set up equipment on farms to provide internet connectivity to machines and vehicles. Other businesses, such as Brazilian telecom companies Oi and TIM, are doing something similar. TIM joined forces with agricultural product suppliers such as AGCO Corp, Case, Bayer, and Trimble to develop the Conectar Agro program. This software program operates 4G internet connections, among the fastest in the world. Rafael Marques is marketing director at TIM, which signed agreements to provide 4G internet to two major farming groups in Brazil. He says the lack of internet harms Brazilian farmers' ability to be competitive in the market. He noted, "The farmer wants to use apps in the field. He wants to send a video to his agronomist when he sees a problem. They want to be online." TIM hopes to reach 5 million hectares of farms covered by internet by the end of the year. In all, Brazil has around 65 million hectares of farmland. TIM's competitor Oi signed a deal to provide internet to one of the farms directed by soybean producer and trader Amaji. It will bring internet to the 87,000-hectare Tucanaré farm in Mato Grosso State.
At a Roman Catholic high school in the United States, students divide into groups to discuss once restricted issues, abusive relationships, and consent. Central Catholic High School recently began using educators from a domestic violence shelter to teach students about what it means to give consent to sexual activity. The goal is to reduce sexual violence and abuse among young people and help them understand what behavior is acceptable and what is not before they become adults. Central Catholic High is in the western U.S. city of Portland, Oregon. David Blue is the school's director of diversity and inclusion. He said, "We're talking about dating violence, sexual assault, relationships, hashtag MeToo, all of those things." Blue spoke to the Associated Press.
What is taking place at his school represents a larger debate. Lawmakers, educators, and teens are asking themselves whether sex education should be changed to better deal with some of the issues raised by the Me Too movement against sexual abuse. At the center of the debate is whether schools should expand their programs to help students understand consent, something that is defined differently from state to state. Jennifer Driver is State Policy Director of the Sexuality Information and Education Council of the United States, which supports liberal sex education policies. Driver says the Me Too movement has brought the issue of consent into the national spotlight. She added that it is clear some people still struggle with the cultural change that is happening. Driver said, "When done right, sex education can serve as violence prevention. But first, we have to get these policies enacted."
Already this year, lawmakers in many state legislatures have considered sex education bills. But only 5 states have passed such measures. And just 2 require clearly defined directives about consent. That information comes from the Guttmacher Institute, which studies sexuality and reproductive health issues. In all, 10 states and the District of Columbia require that consent be part of the sex education program. More than 30 states require that teachers talk about abstinence in sex ed programs. Abstinence, in this case, is the practice or custom of avoiding or not having sex. In recent years, most federal money for sex education has gone to abstinence programs. The divide over how to teach sex education has long split on the question of whether children are sexual beings, said Jonathan Zimmerman. He serves as professor of history of education at the University of Pennsylvania. At times, sex education classes have taught students clear and detailed information about sex, as well as birth control and sexually transmitted diseases. At other times, the classes are almost entirely abstinence-centered.
With the Me Too movement, some Americans see sex education classes as a way to reduce sexual violence. This year, lawmakers in Oklahoma considered a bill that would have required state high schools to teach consent. The measure is called Lauren's Law. It is named for a student who said she was raped at a high school party. The Oklahoma legislature went on to pass a narrower measure requiring that schools with a sex ed program teach consent. It does not require the same from schools that do not offer sex education classes. As with most issues in education, local school officials play a big part in shaping sex education curriculum. Many state laws on sex education are written in an unclear way, on purpose. The southern state of Tennessee requires an abstinence-based curriculum. But some students there are leading their own discussions about consent. In the city of Memphis, students are active with an organization called Memphis Against Sexual Harassment and Assault. As part of the group, they have taken part in a campaign designed to spread recognition of sexual abuse and violence. They also have held training events that teach about consent.
These issues are personal to Devin Dearmore and Savannah Thompson. Dearmore, who is 18, said she was sexually harassed by a worker at her school. 15-year-old Thompson said she was groped and held against a wall by another student when she was in eighth grade. She later was blamed for the incident. Thompson told the AP, "We're being taught all of these things, preparing us for college. But they're not teaching you how to cope with things that can derail your life. That's where our school system and school systems nationwide have failed us. In middle and elementary school, I didn't know I could say no." Some who oppose teaching consent believe it signals an approval of teen sexual activity. Marianne Mossick heads an abstinence education group called Ascend. She said it has been talking about consent for years, but with the idea that avoiding sex is your best choice. Ascend has trained about 1,500 educators in public and private schools, as well as other places. Critics of abstinence-based programs say they close down urgently needed discussions. And they say if their goal is to reduce sexual activity, their results appear questionable. A study published last month found that Memphis was first among 17 areas named in the study in the rate of boys who had sex before they were teenagers. The study found 1 in 4 boys have sex before their 13th birthday. The Journal of the American Medical Association reported the findings. I'm Katie Weaver.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. The D-Day invasion of June 6, 1944 was the largest amphibious assault in history, and it led to the end of World War II in Europe. Allied forces stormed the beaches at Normandy, France. The invasion marked a turning point in the war in Europe as Hitler's hold on the continent began to crumble. On today's Making of a Nation, we take you back to that event, beginning with a decision by the Allied commander, General Dwight David Eisenhower. On June 5, 1944, a huge Allied force waited for the order to invade German-occupied France. The invasion had been planned for the day before, but a storm forced a delay. At 3:30 in the morning, the Allied commander, General Dwight Eisenhower, was meeting with his aides. The storm still blew outside the building. General Eisenhower and the other generals were discussing whether they should attack the next day. A weatherman entered the room. He reported that the weather would soon improve. All eyes turned toward Eisenhower. The decision was his. His face was serious, and for a long time he was silent. Finally, he spoke. "Okay," he said. "We will go." And so the largest military invasion ever known, D-Day, took place on June 6, 1944. The German leader, Adolf Hitler, had known the invasion was coming, but he did not know where the Allied force would strike. Most Germans expected the Allies would attack at Calais, but they were wrong. Eisenhower planned to strike along the French coast of Normandy, across the English Channel. The Second World War was then almost 5 years old. The Germans had won the early battles and gained control of most of Europe. But in 1942 and 43, the Allies slowly began to gain back land from the Germans in North Africa, Italy, and Russia. And now, finally, the British, American, Canadian, and other Allied forces felt strong enough to attack across the English Channel. Eisenhower had 150,000 men and 12,000 planes for the attack. But most importantly, he had surprise on his side. Even after the invasion began, General Erwin Rommel and other German military leaders could not believe that the Allies had really attacked at Normandy. But attack they did. On the night of June 5th, thousands of Allied soldiers parachuted behind German lines. Then, Allied planes began dropping bombs on German defenses. And in the morning, thousands of ships approached the beaches, carrying men and supplies. The battle quickly became fierce and bloody. The Germans had strong defenses. They were better protected than the Allied troops on the beaches. But the Allied soldiers had greater numbers. Slowly, they moved forward on one part of the coast, then another.
People of Western Europe, a landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force.
General Dwight Eisenhower.
This landing is part of the concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe. I have this message for all of you. Although the initial assault may not have been made in your own country, the hour of your liberation is approaching. All patriots, men and women, young and old, have a part to play in the achievement of final victory. To members of resistance movements, Whether led by nationals or by outside leaders, I say, follow the instructions you have received. To patriots who are not members of organized resistance groups, I say, continue your passive resistance, but do not needlessly endanger your lives. Wait until I give you the signal to rise and strike the enemy.
The Allies continued to build up their forces in France. Within 1 week, they brought nearly 90,000 vehicles and 600,000 men into France, and they pushed ahead. Hitler was furious. He screamed at his generals for not blocking the invasion, and he ordered his troops from nearby areas to join the fight and stop the Allied force. But the Allies would not be stopped. In late August, the Allied forces liberated Paris from the Germans. People cheered wildly as General Charles de Gaulle and free French troops marched into the center of the city. The Allies then moved east into Belgium. They captured the port of Antwerp. This made it easier for them to send supplies and fuel to their troops. Only when Allied troops tried to move into the Netherlands did the Germans succeed in stopping them. American forces won battles at Eindhoven and Nijmegen, but German forces defeated British Red Devil troops in a terrible fight at Arnhem. Germany's brief victory stopped the Allied invasion for the moment, but in less than 4 months, General Eisenhower and the Allied forces had regained almost all of France. At the same time, in 1944, the Soviets were attacking Germany from the east. Earlier, Soviet forces had succeeded in breaking German attacks at Stalingrad, Moscow, and Leningrad. Soviet forces recaptured Russian cities and farms one by one. They entered Finland, Poland, and Romania. By the end of July, Soviet soldiers were just 15 kilometers from the Polish capital, Warsaw. What happened next was one of the most terrible events of the war. Moscow radio called on the people of Poland to rise up against the German occupation forces. Nearly 40,000 men in the Polish underground army listened to the call, and they attacked the Germans. The citizens of Warsaw probably could have defeated the German occupation forces if the Soviet army had helped them. But Soviet leader Joseph Stalin betrayed the Poles. He knew that many members of the Polish underground forces opposed communism as much as they opposed the Germans. He feared they would block his efforts to establish a new Polish government that was friendly to Moscow. For this reason, Stalin held his forces outside Warsaw. He waited while the Germans and Poles killed each other in great numbers. The Germans finally forced the citizens of Warsaw to surrender. The real winner of the battle, however, was the Soviet Union. Both the Germans and the Poles suffered heavy losses during the fighting. The Soviet army had little trouble taking over the city with the help of Polish communists. And after the war, the Free Polish Forces were too weak to oppose a communist government loyal to Moscow. Adolf Hitler was in serious trouble. Allied forces were attacking from the west. Soviet troops were passing through Poland and moving in from the east. And at home, several German military officials tried to assassinate him. The German leader narrowly escaped death when a bomb exploded in a meeting room. But Hitler refused to surrender. Instead, he planned a surprise attack in December 1944. He ordered his forces to move quietly through the Ardennes forest and attack the center of the Allied line. He hoped to break through the line, separate the Allied forces, and regain control of the war. The Germans attacked American troops, tired from recent fighting in another battle. It was winter. The weather was so bad that Allied planes could not drop bombs on the German forces. The Germans quickly broke through the American line. But the German success did not last long. Allied forces from nearby areas raced to the battlefront to help, and good weather allowed Allied planes to begin attacking the Germans. The battle ended by the middle of the following month in a great defeat for Hitler and the Germans. The German army lost more than 100,000 men and great amounts of supplies. The end of the war in Europe was now in sight. By late February 1945, the Germans were forced to retreat across the Rhine River. American forces led by General George Patton drove deep into the German heartland. To the east, Soviet forces also were marching into Germany. It did not take long for the American and Soviet forces to meet in victory. The war in Europe was ending. Adolf Hitler waited until Russian troops were destroying Berlin. Bombs and shells were falling everywhere. In his underground bunker, Hitler took his own life by shooting himself in the head. Several of his closest aides also chose to die in the Führer bunker. One week later, the German army surrendered to Eisenhower and the Allies.
Yesterday morning at 2:41 a.m. at General Eisenhower's headquarters, General Jodl, the representative of the German High Command, and of Grand Admiral Dönitz, the designated head of the German state, signed the act of unconditional surrender of all German land, sea, and air forces in Europe to the Allied expeditionary forces and simultaneously to the Soviet High Command.
British Prime Minister Winston Churchill.
Hostilities will end officially at 1 minute after midnight tonight, Tuesday, the 8th of May. We may allow ourselves a brief period of rejoicing. Today is Victory in Europe Day. Long live the cause of freedom.
The defeat of Germany was cause for great celebration in Britain, the United States, and other Allied nations. But two facts made the celebrations less joyful than they might have been. One was the discovery by Allied troops of the German death camps. Only at the end of the war did most of the world learn that the Nazis had murdered millions of innocent Jews and other people. The second fact was that the Pacific War had not ended. Japanese and American forces were still fighting bitterly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.